make your website show the user the benefit they get rather than how clever you are. All the hard work that you're doing is of no interest to your end user.
The Startup Sensations Podcast. First-hand accounts of the real stories behind the successes, challenges, and opportunities of starting and growing a startup company. From both sides of the pond. With Bulent Osman and Shelley Bays.
And welcome back to another episode of the Startup Sensations podcast with me, Bulent Osman, still here in the UK, just outside of London.
And me, Shelley Bays, on the Northern California coast, where probably unlike London, the sun is shining. How are you, Bulent?
Well, I'm well, thank you, but I'm not sure I want to hear that right now.
Sorry.
But what I do want to hear is this particular episode, because it's going to be really, really, I think, action-packed. With a wonderful guest. A lot of people in the UK will know this company. The guest is called Anthony Rose. He is the founder and CEO of Seed Legals.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting because this is a sort of automation of some of the legal issues that startup founders face and need to take very seriously. And we've heard from some excellent lawyers in prior episodes about the importance of making sure that your housekeeping around legal issues is done properly, contracts, et cetera. And I'm interested to hear Anthony describe his company and how they have automated certain aspects of that. They aren't a full replacement in any way, but it will be interesting to hear what he has to say because I think they are doing very, very well, which means they have a super product.
And I'm delighted to say that Anthony Rose now joins us from central London. Anthony, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I am very well. Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you, Anthony. Looking forward to this.
Thank you.
Well, Anthony, I'm really excited to have you on the show. As a UK entrepreneur myself, you know, your company is very familiar to me. Seed Legals, I've used myself, and I know that a lot of my UK colleagues actually use the platform. But for our US audience who may not have come across your company, can you just share with our audience what your platform does and indeed your role within the business today?
Yes, I'm the founder, co-founder and CEO at Seed Legals. So the idea with Seed Legals is instead of you going to a law firm when you're doing a funding round, when you want to give share options to your team, when you need all those little contracts to grow your business, there's a platform for that. So imagine there was a platform and you specified on the platform, which is open 24/7 with the team there to help. They don't charge by the minute, by the hour. It's all included. And then it builds all the contracts for you. But then we use data to show you what you probably want to agree to. Because one of the problems we found is that it's not the making of the contract, which is the difficult thing. It's knowing what you should be agreeing to. Am I the only idiot agreeing to these crazy investor terms? Or am I making a big drama about something that is completely standard? Well, actually, you can go and look at Seed Legals' thermometer that shows you what's market standard. So in short, Seed Legals, we're a 160-person company. We're in the UK, France, and Ireland. About one in three of all early-stage funding rounds in the UK go through our platform. And if you're in the US, I know that companies are not using a platform typically. They are spending a lot of time and money with lawyers, and my goal later on in the year is to change that.
I'm really keen to know about the genesis of the company. In other words, you know, 8 or 9 years ago before you started it, what were you thinking? What drove you to come up with the idea? And what were the early days like of your startup business?
Most people would be slightly surprised to know I'm not a lawyer. I'm a tech guy. I'm a media person. So I used to head up BBC iPlayer, the UK equivalent of Hulu and so on in the US. My background is, you know, streaming on the internet, video quality and so on. But after I left the BBC, I built a startup, sold it, built a startup, sold it, invested in a few, met my co-founder in 2016. We met each other at a party and decided to create Seed Legals. And one of the things I really like at the beginning, I was mildly embarrassed that I'm not a lawyer. But I've realized actually a key attribute to if your goal is never to disrupt an industry. Your goal is always to help your customers with a better solution. But the better way to do that is if you're not from the original industry. So if you're from the recording industry, you still want to make vinyl records or CDs, not the internet. And if you're in broadcast, you still want people to be watching television, not TikTok and so on. And likewise, if you want to help people agree things with each other in new ways, you want to be somebody who's not the lawyer. So anyway, my goal was to figure out what startups in particular, being our customers, want to do and come up with a different, more efficient way of solving those problems.
And what were some of the issues that you faced right at the beginning? For example, was there pushback because you're not a lawyer? So what do you know about all these terms? And, you know, why should we listen to you, basically?
When you start a new business, there are a few problems you've got to overcome. Can you find investment? Can you find a co-founder? Can you find and hire team members to build it? Will you ever get product market fit? So will you build something that people really want? So these are your typical problems. And the biggest one that you thought you had was, could you build it? The biggest one in retrospect, you realize you really should have been focused on is, will people actually want it? Then in my case, it was a bit different. You know, I've been around for a while. I was pretty convinced that we could find the money. I could build a tech team. We could build it. And from my research, from talking to founders, I was reasonably confident enough that people would want it. But the big unknown I had was, what if investors said, dude, you can't use Seed Legals? So there I would have founders wanting to use it, and their lawyers or investors would say, you can't. And this was a big gamble for me. So, you know, like all companies, when you want to make a bet, your goal is to try and learn the answer by doing the least amount of work possible. Your dev team always likes building stuff. And for me, building stuff is the failure to have a product without building stuff. This is sometimes called fake it till you make it. Not Terranos style, but so how could I learn at Seed Legals whether people really wanted it? So what I did initially is I built sort of the front end of the website with the questions that the platform will answer. But we hadn't built the document generation technology. Oh, it was pretty buggy, and most of the time it didn't work. The user would go through the interface, and it would be, you know, like a swan gliding nicely across the lake. But beneath, there was frantic paddling. And so they would enter the data, the information, and then our legal team would frantically build the Word document. For the customer, they got a high quality, you know, result checked by a lawyer, written by a lawyer. But for my team, they're going, Anthony, we're dying here. Help. We can't take it. And so I realized I had to then automate it before the team keeled over or left. The key thing you learn is that in your mind, you've got the set of features that you're obsessed on building because you think people want it. And in reality, once you've launched, you realize half the features you built, nobody actually wanted. And you could have built in half the time. And the other thing you learn is another R that you never thought of that people really want. So if you can get a product live, doing things manually in the back end, then you can get a product out faster and save yourself a huge amount of time and money building features that nobody wanted, and then quickly build the things that they really did want.
The whole platform, Anthony, is pretty disruptive, especially when you launched it about 8 years ago. What was the traction like? How did you convince people to start switching away from the safe area of working with lawyers and actually trusting a software platform like yours?
So that was really interesting. And I learned a few things, which I sort of assumed, and some things were a complete surprise. So the real problem initially is trust. And people would go, you know, this is the future of my startup. People can sue me. You know, it's not like a tiny thing. This is a big thing. It's not like I'm going to order some peanuts on the internet. If I don't like them, I'll throw them away. If I get my funding round wrong, I'm dead. So establishing trust was very difficult. You'd get on a call, you know, as the founder, you're often the first salesperson. So I was literally on a beanbag outside our office in the corridor. So I didn't annoy the team. The customer, potential customer would go, you've done a great demo. This looks awesome. How many funding rounds have you done? I'd go, oh, three. And that was quite difficult. And so I was wishing, how do I get it to like a number that sounds reasonable? Now I can say a third of all rounds like thousands have been done, but this is something that you have to work hard to get to. So the trust is important. And I think it's then the founders putting themselves on the line, explaining that an expert's going to check everything, that you're there to call anytime. And then you'll find early adopters. And I think that's one of the key things in any industry, you know, be it people buying Teslas or anything. Some people are laggards and you should just identify those and not waste your time trying to convert them. Others will be mainstream adopters. They'll wait a bit longer, and some will be early adopters. And interestingly, founders in early stage companies are the perfect example of early adopters. Why? Because they don't have much money. They just want a solution. They're also building solutions to disrupt other industries. So they know exactly about the problem and they like to support others. And of course, they're also used to SaaS systems that are always on, monthly billing. And so they want the new world. And if you can tap into that, then that's good. And that perfectly aligned with my business.
One of the things that we hear a lot and we know ourselves is if there isn't a market, if this is the first thing in the market to be invented, it's a question of whether it's really needed. So there had to be others thinking the same kinds of thoughts you and your co-founder thought about. Oh, this legal world is a mess and expensive. Is there other competition out there, which I think you're going to say yes? And how is it different? In other words, how did you leapfrog ahead and get to where you are vis-a-vis some of the other competitors?
There are other players. You can download, you know, legal templates off the internet and so on. But we're the first and actually pretty much are still the only one that has a complete platform approach. So there are many sites you can Google, I want an employment agreement, and you'll download a template. But there's nothing that acts as a database that has the details of all your team and can tell you the salaries across everyone and the monthly compensation and does the e-signing of the platform and then does the share and options issues and so on. So thinking about it as a platform perspective. And I realize that the reason others in this space were not doing this is because most people building legal tech companies are disaffected lawyers. They're people who work in a law firm, they decide they don't want to work for a law firm, and their goal is to build things that make law firms more efficient. And my goal was to build something which meant you didn't need to use a law firm at all. And here, the learning, I think, for founders is to make your website show the user the benefit they get rather than how clever you are. So let me explain, because that was the epiphany for me, which is when we started Seed Legals, the website said, you know, we do contract automation and document generation, basically showing how clever you are and what you're doing. But then I realized nobody wakes up in the morning and goes, we're looking for document generation. No, they want to do a funding round or they want to hire somebody or get investment or something. So I completely redid the website, you know, the fastest way to raise investment, or here's how to incentivize your team, or, you know, need to do something, here's how. So all the hard work that you're doing is of no interest to your end user. I think a perfect example is, you know, booking.com. They don't say, we use advanced analytics and AI to connect you with relevant travel destinations. They just go, where do you want to go today? You type it in and they come up with some things. If you can make your website act as if all the clever stuff you're doing, blockchain, whatever, is swept underneath, you're just giving the customer the output they want, then I think that's a key advantage. And so that's really what I try to do, which of course means always thinking what your customer wants and not what your legal team wants, which you can do more easily if you're not a lawyer as the founder. So there's the 360 on that.
Are there times even you would say you do need a lawyer? And does your website or your company help people make that decision also?
I think we, you know, what we've done is we've productized a narrow area of, you know, contract law, essentially. So particularly around startups, fundraising, share option schemes, and so on. But if you're doing divorces or, you know, insolvency, we don't do that. So
criminal defense or something like that. Yeah, right.
Exactly. And in the UK, what's interesting is there are so-called reserved areas of law. So criminal, And some others are like 6 or 7 where you have to be a regulated law firm to do that. But outside of that, you don't have to be a law firm. And so it's Seed Legals. We definitely wouldn't go into those reserved areas. But then taking a step back, you know, you can ask us about commercial contracts for supply of services. Actually, we don't do that. So what happens is anyone asking for something outside of our zone will recommend a law firm partner. And we have a great two-way relationship with those partners. They send people to us for fundraising and we send people to them for the things we don't do.
Anthony, I'm interested in your plans to go to the US. You know, as a podcast that covers both sides of the pond, one of the themes that we like to explore on this show is advice for UK founders in terms of moving and expanding into the US. What preparation have you gone through? What research have you done? What are your thoughts about your own challenges in establishing Seed Legals in the US market?
You know, I said earlier that one of the important things is you learn what people really want before you build it, because otherwise most people think they're going to build something and people will come. So in the UK, we are very popular, but the question is, will the formula that's worked here work in the US? So I want to be confident. There are different players in the US. It doesn't have the same tax incentives and angel scheme. And so, you know, you can easily make a disastrously bad bet that costs you millions. So how do I learn beforehand? I think the other really interesting thing, and again, to try and answer in a way that is of value to anyone listening, is for those who don't know the terms PLG and CLG. So one is product-led growth and the other is community-led growth. The product-led growth is kind of builders and they'll come. You create a great product, you set up a website, people will find you. Okay, you have to do marketing, run LinkedIn ads, you know, run pay-per-click ads, but your product will sort of, with some help, sell itself. Community-led growth says get involved in a community, build relationships, and your community will tell each other about your product, and that will then lead to the network effect, and people will be coming to you. And what I've found is that I do an insane number of events. I mean, last year I did something like 140 events between webinars, podcasts, physical events, and so we are quite, you know, ubiquitous in a startup scene in London. And so everyone knows us. But in a new territory, how do you get started? I mean, maybe I have to be on a plane and in New York, but the US market is huge. So key things for me are understanding whether your growth can benefit from a community. So startup founders hang around in the same place. They're listening and watching this podcast. But other communities or other audiences might not. So if you're selling accounting software, that's kind of any company. They've probably, maybe they are hanging around in the same place. But if you can find communities, they could be WhatsApp message groups, you know, Facebook groups, LinkedIn groups, wherever people are communicating with each other, if you can be part of those, this is a really valuable way of marketing and reaching an audience. So my challenge is, how do I learn what people are really looking for in the US so that I don't go, ta-da, we're here. And people go, dude, we don't need one of those. And number two is, how do I, you know, become part of those communities? Everyone knows that valuations are like 10x higher in the US than the UK, and companies raise tons more money. So it's really appealing for founders to think, I'm going to do what's called the Delaware flip. I'm going to make a Delaware company, and then I'm going to fundraise in the US, and I'm going to get much more money. The challenge is that just making a US top code doesn't change anything. It seems the advice is, if you're planning to move or expand to the US, there's advice from Octopus Ventures that says go early or go late, but don't go in between, which means if it's two founders, get on a plane, move to Palo Alto or whatever, get in a garage and build your startup there. Will go late means get to your Series B, 10, 20 million pounds a year revenue, mature product, tested in the market. And so you can now spend a few million on a US launch and it's not going to kill the company if it doesn't work. But don't go while you're still trying to find product market fit in your home territory, because now your team's going to be building twice as much stuff, focused on two things instead of one thing. And you've actually made life much harder for yourself. And also investors will probably be looking, if you're a UK company, to see that you are successful in the UK and now needing to raise capital to now go into a market that's, you know, 7x or 10x the size with valuation and so on to match. So that's like the 2 minutes on US expansion.
No, that's excellent advice. I mean, for yourself, though, presumably you'll need a whole bank of US lawyers, US documents, because everything, in fact, your products will be very different. Everything at the moment is UK-centric or perhaps European-centric. So how are you going to go about, in effect, although the platform will be the same, presumably, but the actual core products, the documents will be different?
I think we've looked at the US documents, and actually we think it's not a big deal. A cap table is a cap table. You just spell flavor without the U. And they're called stock options instead of share options. And it's common stock instead of ordinary share. I mean, there's more to it than that, but the basis is pretty similar. The difficult thing is how you then create a beachhead to come up and become part of new communities for people who didn't know you to now start knowing you. And to me, I think that's a much bigger challenge. Obviously, you have to make sure that somebody in your target market, when they look at your product, it doesn't look like a product from a different market where they've just put a veneer of, you know, gloss and a US flag on it or something. And for me, you know, being in France, it was important that our French customers didn't see this was like Les Anglais, et cetera. And it looked natively French.
And when you start on the West Coast, a move across or on the East Coast?
Okay, so again, to try and put that in, you know, advice for any UK company, there's actually a site that helps you pick a location and you enter some information. I think they always say Virginia is the place to go. Now, whatever you do. But broadly, it seems that you can pick lifestyle things like Miami, up-and-coming hubs like Texas, or established places like New York, Boston, or San Francisco. And so in our space, it looks like the key startup places are, you know, West Coast, San Francisco, Palo Alto, or Los Angeles, or East Coast, which is New York or Boston. I'd go East Coast because it's easier for London. That's a common one. You know, it's easy to fly and enough time zone sync with your team.
We're looking forward to hearing about your plans. And will it be in 2024 or is it likely to be perhaps next year?
I would love to see it this year. I've got my work cut out between now and then, but I would like to. The way that you built things once upon a time was build it and they will come. So you put all the effort into building it and then see if anyone uses it. But startups have learned that's not the way to do it. It's in fact create a prototype, an MVP. And if people want it, build the rest of it. And if not, give up and pivot or do something else. But I think you can go a step further, which is do the press release that you've launched it. And if nobody comes, don't even build it. Now, obviously, you can't quite do that because if people go, great, where do I sign up? And you go, I haven't built it. That's a bit silly. But, you know, you can do it as if it was there. And that's, in fact, the reason I was at this conference in Miami where I, you know, made a presentation of, you know, mock-up of a US proposition and said, essentially, you know, if there was this, is this of interest? Then people went, no, actually, this, we use one of these and this doesn't work here. Then I shouldn't even bother and just spend a few days in Miami. But it turned out it was the opposite. People went, that's awesome. We don't think there's anything like it. You know, one of the challenges is there's so much noise and everything, so many announcements that if you can't get the press to pick up something and run with it, and you can't have something that's different, you will never get traction. And so actually announcing it, and if the announcement itself, you just can't put it in a way that anyone's going to be interested in it, you've probably realized at that point, however clever your product is, you're going to have to work so hard to get customers. And so if your announcement is, you know, another credit card for founders, you know, you probably get 5 a week. Well, what are you going to do that's different? What I call the shtick. What's the shtick that's different? And if you can't find the shtick that's different, you are going to have to spend a lot more on paid advertising, or it's going to be really hard to find customers, or just keep doing something to find the shtick that will have people think about you rather than someone else.
Take us back, and I know that there's a story when you were 21 and you were in Cape Town, when you had a little brush with the law. So can you just share with us what happened then?
Okay, so my background is actually electronics. When I was still at school, I made circuit boards and essentially created a business in the days before anyone thought about startups, the word startups and fundraising, in the days where the only way to have a business was for it to be profitable. These days, you get lots of money from investors, build stuff, and hope one day to get revenue. That in those days, you know, as a kid, I had to make circuit boards and then sell the circuit boards for more than the cost of the components so that I could do more of it. And one of the things I did for fun was I had an Alfa Romeo GTV and I wanted to go faster. And so I made a system for measuring the speed very accurately with magnets on the wheels in the days of like an Apple II computer, and made a means for measuring the speed. And then I would drive, put it in neutral, and then I could measure the aerodynamics. And then I put streamers on it and videoed it and so on. So the idea was to make less air resistance to go faster. And then I thought, I wonder if I can get a government permission to exceed the speed limit. So I wrote a letter to the energy minister. These were the days when South Africa had some sanctions. Fuel was very expensive. And I explained that if 10% of the cars could save 10% of their fuel through better, you know, aerodynamics, it would save the country this number of millions. And to do this, I needed to do some research. And I had very nice printouts from my computer program that I wrote in the days that, you know, they were like those IBM mainframes. And I expected to hear nothing. But I thought I'd give it a go. And a few months went by. And then I got on this official government stationery signed by the minister. I had government permission to exceed the speed limit, so long as there was signage on the car that mentioned it. So I had a sticker made saying government license to exceed speed limits and put this on my Alfa and drove around Cape Town, mostly to the beach. Occasionally, I would get pulled over by the police and they would say, so you can't go around driving like that. And I'd open the glove box and take out the official stationery. And there was a look on the, inevitably, the police person's face, which is, life is so unfair. Followed by, have a good day, sir. And so it was at the point that I guess at that stage I realized, you know, you need to take the initiative. If you don't ask, you won't get. I didn't actually do much to make the car go faster other than put nitrous oxide in, which then blew up the engine. So yes, it was a fun story there. But I do think about every time you go, did I try that? Like, no, it won't work. No, give it a go. You know, what's the worst that will happen?
So did that fuel your kind of entrepreneurial spirit, really? The fact that you did something a little bit outrageous and you sort of got away with it. Did that make you think, well, maybe I can do other things and get away with it as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think the starting point, I have to say, for my founder goals is when I was, I think, probably like 15 or so, I'd go into the local Apple computer store in Cape Town, and I was friendly with the team there. They were really geeky. It was a small shop, not like the giant Apple stores today. It was like four people with a few computers. I made circuit boards, and I took one to show them. And there was a guy, an American guy, running one of them, and he said, that's great, I'll take 20. Like, what? You want to buy this thing I'm doing as a hobby? And so I then realized, wait, there's like actually people give you money for doing this stuff? That's amazing. And I actually sat on, you know, the around the kitchen table with my mother and brother and sister assembling the boxes to put these in, and that turned into a business. So if you come up with something that people want, there's a market, of course, and then it takes you on a different random path that you never imagined before.
So how did you get from South Africa as a teenager or young adult through to London, and then you're involved with the BBC? You headed up iPlayer, which most people here in the UK, of course, use nearly every day. So tell us about that transition. How did you make that jump?
Well, I was studying university, and you know, I'd look up from home. You could see the University of Cape Town on the hill, and you'd look and go, "There's tear gas coming out. There's another student." Right? I don't think I'm going to go to uni today, and it was clear that it was time to leave the country and move on. And so we looked around the world and decided Australia was great. And so we moved to Australia, and I was living in Australia for about 20 years. I went to various media conferences and so on from the things I was doing there, and bumped into a few times a guy called Eric Huggins, who was heading up Future Media at the BBC. And one day he called me and said, how would you like to join the BBC? And I went, the BBC, where are the stock options? Because there aren't any. But I was persuaded to move to London in 2007 and head up iPlayer. And that was obviously a big challenge, different country, not a startup, and a high-profile project. And the BBC is quite well known for its internal politics. And everyone told me, everyone's going to try and micromanage your project and tell you what you can and can't do, and the politics are a disaster. What I learned quickly is everyone expected it to be a complete disaster and therefore kept away from me. They thought that when this train wreck happens, we want to be nowhere nearby. So anytime I said, we need to do X, people went, whatever, knock yourself out, I'll be over there. So I got kind of, you know, people kept out of the way, which then meant we could get on with things. But I also learned a key early lesson. When I arrived, it was, the iPlayer hadn't launched yet, and it was a bit all over the shop. Nothing worked very well. And I had a hard time explaining to the team, 100 different things didn't work. For me, it's all about finding out what your customers really want. That's everything in a startup. It's all about your users and customers. So my team didn't believe me when I said, this needs to be like this, and this didn't be like. So I figured I need to find a customer and do customer testing. And so I went to the team at the BBC that does testing, and they said, yep, we can do testing for you. It'll cost £20,000 and take 6 weeks. I went, there's no way I'm spending £20,000. And my product launches in 3 months. I don't have 6 weeks to wait for some tests. So I developed what I call Anthony's chocolate box method, where I went to the local supermarket and bought several large boxes of Lindt chocolates. And then I went to non-technical people in the building, as in the legal team typically, and said, I will give you this fine box of chocolates if you test my product. And so I'd assemble the developer team in a room with a big projector TV, and then sit the person down and say, what's your favorite show? Please find it. And the first time we did this, it was a complete disaster. Everything went wrong, and the team were mouths open afterwards. Okay, we're going to pick the top three things that didn't work, and we're going to fix it in the next 48 hours. It took a bit longer. And after doing this just three or four times, the next person said, my favorite program is X. Oh, there it is on the homepage. Click. Oh, there it plays. So it was all about customer-driven development, as I now call it, and rapid iteration, and actually putting your use or customers in front of your developers so your developers see how people really behave. And it wasn't really anything ultimately more than that. You just keep going until you have something that your customers really love and can use.
Well, to follow that theme on to maybe our final question, really, which is if you were to take out your crystal ball, as it seems that you have one and you've used it for most of your life, how do you think the next few years will go? I mean, you know, we're in the midst of another gold rush, we think, around AI and artificial intelligence, and it just seems to pick up enormous amount of pace. This will be very challenging for some and amazing for others. What's your perspective on that, and how will things look for entrepreneurs and the whole sort of startup ecosystem in the next few years?
I think firstly, if you are thinking about starting a business, you know, you might think the time is not now. And for me, procrastination in a startup is death. You know, of course, if you've got a day job, don't give up the day job until you're confident what you want to do. But if you're thinking things will be better in future, you should assume everything's going to be worse in future. Yeah, I see founders going, we're going to delay our funding round because valuations will be up, but they weren't. So if that was their strategy, they in desperate times or out of business. So maybe fundraising will back, but who knows what next war will come along, or disease, or some random thing that makes everything difficult. In my view, once you've established you want to do something, you should do it without delay, and you should never do it on an assumption that, you know, the good times will be back. And even if that is the case, if fundraising valuations are up again, what's going to happen is everyone who's been waiting will now be out fundraising. So you're going to have more competition. And guess what? If you do manage to raise investment, you're now going to be competing for an employee pool that has lots of job offers. And so right now, it's easy to hire people because there are layoffs. I mean, you have to have money to be able to hire them. But there is ready availability of tech, engineering, and other talent. So if you can be counter-cyclical, that is good. Not waiting, I think, is always the thing to do, not procrastinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on that note, Anthony, we want to thank you for your time. It's been an absolutely brilliant conversation, full of amazing advice. And we love hearing a lot about you and your background as well. And we wish you all the best with launching Seed Legals in the US. I mean, if people want to find you or contact you or actually find Seed Legal, especially our American listeners, where should they go?
Yes, so seedlegals.com is the website. Anthony Rose on LinkedIn. I would love to connect. If you have any advice, are you looking for questions or answers, whether it be UK or US? If you're a UK founder, I'm here to answer all questions, whether I'm selling anything or not. Everyone in the startup community knows that. And if you're in the US, I'd love to learn more about what US founders are looking for. And you can also drop me an email directly at anthony@seedlegals.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for your time, Anthony. It's been a great conversation and we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And I'm really pleased to say that Anthony has kindly given listeners to the Startup Sensations podcast a special discount of £50 off any one of their one-off products or annual subscriptions for all new clients. To get your £50 discount, simply enter the code SEEDLEGALS50 at the checkout at seedlegals.com. You'll also find these details in the show notes. Well, Shelley, that was an action-packed conversation with Anthony, wasn't it? And, you know, one that probably listeners may want to listen to a couple of times. There was just so much there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is full of very, very useful information.
Well, a key theme, I think, Shelley, was all about building a successful company from scratch. That was the key theme. And at the beginning, he talked about, you know, his desire for Seed Legals, not necessarily to disrupt the legal sector, but to come up with a better product. And he spoke very eloquently, I thought, about the whole issue of building a minimum viable product, but continuing to improve it. And this customer feedback loop, you know, show it to some customers and make sure that you get the feedback from those customers so you continuously improve and make it fit for purpose. I think most businesses today don't do that enough. They maybe do that a little bit at the beginning, but I think it's a continuous process. I think one of his secrets for success was that he took that incredibly seriously. He did it in a very focused sort of way. And he pivoted a few times, you know, and it's good to pivot, to make micro pivots, to make sure that really what you're building serves a real purpose for your target customer audience.
And he even talked about that in terms of going to the US, because one of the big questions was, you know, when are you going to go to the US with Seed Legals and what's your thinking about doing that? And, you know, again, he had some very important points, one of which is one needs to learn ahead of time if the product or the technology or whatever it is a fit for the US market. And that's an important entry point. He talked about product-led growth, but also community-led growth and how that will be especially important for entering the US or entering any country, quite honestly. But I loved his piece of advice, which was go early or go late. Go move there, rent a garage and build your product from scratch, or wait till you have a functioning company, a functioning product, you're maybe in your Series B, and then go when you've minimized the risk overall. And, you know, honestly, he's really someone to talk about risk because that went through his personal life as he talked about the things he did leading up to his current role.
Yeah, no, he did. And that lovely story about him negotiating with the South African police so he can break the speed limit in his car.
That was great.
That was fantastic. The point being that he took risks and he was able to think outside the box, push his luck maybe sometimes, you know, but his personal background is full of that. You know, he was able to take risk, but, you know, at times wing it, you know, and don't be frightened to pivot. Don't be frightened to try something. It doesn't quite work. Maybe change it until you find something that really hits the mark, and then push ahead with that and don't procrastinate.
He said, look, you know, luck always plays a role. And wouldn't it be great if we were all lucky? But opportunistic grabbing of a chance or a challenge is also a way of making your own luck. He talked about that. Understand what you're good at. So when you grab opportunities, at least you think you have a chance of making it a success. And yeah, he did talk about don't procrastinate. Don't sit there and wait for the perfect moment, because the perfect moment won't ever emerge in the way that you think it will. So just do it. I was reminded of Nike, right? Just do it. That was his piece of advice. Seize the day.
Next time on Startup Sensations.
The development opportunities lie in the hands of local entrepreneurs who know what the problems are, they know how to solve it at a low cost, and they know how to find talent locally that can be affordable.
Thanks for listening to Startup Sensations. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform so you never miss an episode. Follow us on the Startup Sensations podcast LinkedIn page and watch video highlights on our YouTube channel. Get in touch with us. Email hello@startupsensations.com. The Startup Sensations podcast.